You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, since 1982, Banned Book Week has taken place to support the expression of ideas, even those considered out of the ordinary or unpopular. We'll talk to the director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. Now, Congress has approved a bill that's been called the biggest overhaul to music copyright law in years. It's called the Music Modernization Act, and it could mean big changes for songwriters and music streaming sites. The bill has broad support from many in the music industry, including artists like Smokey Robinson, who praised the changes it makes to the payment of artists. Here he is speaking before Congress in May.
If we stop paying people because, well, it's only music, well, that's ludicrous because of the fact that their time and effort and creativity went into creating this music that people are getting pleasure from and listening to and having forever and ever.
Amy Wang is a reporter who covers the music and media industries at Rolling Stone. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, if I had one word to describe our music copyright system, it would be complicated. Can you talk about what the state of the art is right now prior to this bill?
That is extremely true. So the way that music copyright works right now can't even be explained in a sentence or a paragraph because there's so many different rules that govern different entities. For instance, the way that artists get paid from radio, like we're listening to right now, is completely different from the way artists get paid from a song coming through your local grocery store speaker system. And the bill really does a lot to bring that together for the modern age, but it still isn't, you know, a cure-all, doesn't establish one central system for artists to get paid. It just helps them sort out the kinks that have been in the system for a while.
And one big change to the system, of course, in recent years is, you know, things like Spotify and Pandora and streaming radio and all these things. Were they kind of gray areas?
That's exactly right. They weren't necessarily gray areas for artists because artists know how much they should be paid and they're very vocal about it. But for services setting up like something like Spotify, which is a music streaming service, there is really no way to get all the music at once. You have to either go to every individual rights holder, every label, every artist in that system and say, let's make a deal for your music, or you can just put all of it on there and get sued. So the Music Modernization Act helps with creating a central authority for that to happen so that on the Spotify side of things, they're okay to just get all that music, and on the artist side of things, they can actually get paid.
Who all gets paid? There's obviously the performer, but they're not the only one who might get a cut or want a cut of a song. Who all is out there?
Mm-hmm. So when you listen to a song, you might think that the money just goes to the artist, and sometimes you think about the record label, but in fact, that's only half the equation. It's the artist, the record label, and by the way, there are also producers and co-writers, co-authors of that song who are singing maybe a chorus or a hook or something. But on the completely other side, there's the publishing of the song, which has to do with the songwriters and the publishers who represent them, and that might be totally different. For instance, a song could be sung by Whitney Houston, but written by a totally different person, and Whitney Houston wouldn't get paid for that part of the song, and vice versa.
Talking to Amy Wang from Rolling Stone about the Music Modernization Act, an effort by Congress, it's passed both houses now, to fix, a lot of people say, how people get money when songs are listened to. So what are the main points of this new legislation? What are some of the big changes that people are looking at?
It's really a bundle of legislation, but some of the key points are that it makes that big entity for things like Spotify and Apple Music to be able to get paid, to be able to make artists get paid and also license their songs correctly. Another thing is that it creates a new royalty rule for pre-1972 recordings. So before the MMA, a lot of artists who recorded songs before that time actually weren't getting paid properly, and they felt, of course, really upset about that, because why should an artist who makes new music in 2018 be getting paid and they can't be? Another thing is that it sets up royalties for producers who previously were kind of in a gray area about whether they should get paid for songs. And one other pretty important thing that it does is that it streamlines the way that the courts set rules for things. So right now, previous to the MMA, there was a court that would basically set rules for, you know, this is the rate that certain radios get paid for their artists and vice versa. But now we have an authority that streamlines the process and makes it a little bit simpler for artists to be able to see how they're getting paid and whether that's fair.
If and when this is signed into law and takes effect, will the average music fan see or feel any kind of difference?
The average music fan probably has no idea what's going on if they're not reading about any of this. But what they should know, the one thing that's really important for them to know, is that copyright law like this and any potential future copyright law that overhauls it for music is going to do a service for the artist and for the songwriter. So those two entities will be getting more money and they'll be seeing more fruits from essentially this product that they've put out there for people. And right now they feel like it's not really doing them a service or a justice if they're not being paid what they're due.
Yeah, I'll admit, I sometimes, if I'm listening to a perfectly legal streaming service, I still feel a little guilty. Like, are people getting ripped off? Am I, in effect, stealing from them? Like, can I do this a little more guilt-free henceforth?
You probably can. At least you can know that the songs you're listening to are fully licensed and legitimate, and that artists are getting a cut of it, songwriters are getting a cut, producers and everybody else. As long as the data is all there and all correct, then it's going to the proper person. Now, how much they get is,
right,
is a different matter.
Right. I wanted to bring that up, because that's a concern I've seen, like people saying, yeah, my song's been streamed or downloaded or whatever millions of times, and, you know, I bought a few postage stamps.
That's exactly right, yeah. So that has to do with the model of streaming services themselves, and there isn't really anything to be done unless someone forced Spotify to raise their prices from $9.99 a month to like $100 a month, and that's never going to happen. So artists on that side really don't have much leeway, but there is like a question of dividing the money between the labels and everybody else. A lot of artists are now wondering whether they should just be completely independent artists so they can get 100% of that side of things and not have to split with a label or anybody else.
And that reminds me, you wrote another piece related to this, not directly about the law, saying that, I think it was Spotify is trying to make it possible to do what you just said. Okay, band, you don't have to go through a label to stream with us.
Exactly, yeah. Spotify has just introduced a new feature where artists can, if they're independent, if they actually own all the copyright to their songs and don't have somebody already doing that for them, they can upload music directly, you know, from their computer to Spotify, which is a pretty cool and radical idea for them, but, you know, a scary one for labels who are wondering if their jobs might be taken over by an artist directly uploading to Spotify.
Now, with this Music Modernization Act, it seems like a lot of stakeholders are happy with it. Are there any holdouts who are saying, no, this is still bad news?
By and large, the industry has been pretty happy about it because it's been merely so long that they've seen something like this happen. So everyone from rights holders to artists themselves to the companies lobbying on their behalf, and even Spotify, Google, Apple, are pretty happy about it. One of the pretty vocal opponents of the bill historically had been Sirius XM because of a certain rule within the bill that said that Sirius had to pay essentially more royalties than it was paying before. And they argue that it was unfair because broadcast radio, which is what we're listening to now, doesn't have to obey the same rules. So that had to be kind of hashed out at the last minute and caused a lot of infighting within the music industry, which wondered, you know, is Sirius going to sort of topple the bill for everybody else? But a compromise was eventually worked out, and it went through.
As we wrap up, is there anybody out there saying yes and? Like, they like this legislation, now they want to see this next thing happen.
Pretty much the entire industry is saying that, yeah. They're saying, this is great, now let's move on to the next thing that we can, you know, fix and streamline and get more money out of, because music is still a pretty tough field to make it in as an artist, and they want more money however much they can get, and from whatever sources they can get, especially as each individual person listening contributes less money, as we just talked about, since they're streaming and not buying a song, contributing that $10 all at once to the artist.
Now, we've been using 8-track laws in the era of streaming. Are there going to be new changes that render all this obsolete in the next 10, 20 years?
Hopefully not. Otherwise, it'll all have to be done again. Streaming seems like it's pretty much here to stay for now. It's growing bigger and bigger. It doesn't seem to have any signs of slowing down or stopping anytime soon. So fingers crossed that we'll have a model that's sustainable and a way for artists to make a living wage continually here and now.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
That's Amy Wang, music and media industry reporter for Rolling Stone. She was with us to talk about a big revamp of music copyright law that's on its way to President Trump's desk for approval. First, last week was Banned Book Week. Organizers say the annual event celebrates the freedom to seek and express ideas. This year's theme is Banning Books, Silences Stories. Due to the airing of the Kavanaugh hearings last week, we were unable to air our interview then. During Banned Books Week, we talked with Jamie LaRue, the director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, last Thursday. Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, take us back to 1982 and why Banned Book Week began.
Well, there has long been a friendly association between librarians and publishers because, you know, our whole business is what they do. And there was an expo in Anaheim, California. And some of the librarians were looking at the wares on display at the expo, and they said, you know, so many of these books are being challenged in our libraries. And so a bunch of them got a bright idea to gather a bunch of these books and put them in the center of the convention. And then they got some big yellow masking tape and put that around it to make it look like a police scene. And that so delighted all of the journalists who saw that that we've been doing it every year since. And at this point, it's probably one of the best recognized programs that the American Library Association does. And it reminds everybody that our freedom to read has to be watched all the time.
Now, once upon a time, books were banned by government agencies from being published. The works of James Joyce and others, there were trials around these. Now you can publish pretty much anything you want in print, online, ebook format. Is this something we really still need to worry about in 2018?
Yeah, it sure is. And I guess I kind of want to push back on this idea that banned only means that the federal government says that it can't come in or it can't be printed. There are many kinds of banning and there are many kinds of governments. So our contention is this. Anybody can challenge a book, and a challenge isn't just complaining about it. It's saying that we think that this school library or public library book should be restricted, meaning it should be harder to get to, or it should be removed altogether. And if it's just challenged, and that happens a lot in America, that's fine. It's okay for people to challenge things. But when a book is removed, a government entity, so we're talking about a school or a public library, a university, is making a decision to remove that book from somebody. And before we say, well, that's, you know, it's still available elsewhere, many of the books that come under challenge most frequently are kind of aimed at young people who are dealing with sometimes difficult issues. And so, as I say, if you're a teen, you know, and you're gay, you don't know that the book was there if somebody complained about it at the school library and it got pulled. Most of the libraries in America are in pretty small rural areas. That teenager doesn't have a credit card to go to Amazon. They don't have a license to drive to the bookstore that's a town over. And so what that means is these decisions to remove books have real consequences for real people.
Now, libraries are curated. They can't have, obviously, all the books in the world. Can you talk about what happens in that process then when someone in the community says, I want to challenge this book. I don't think you should curate it. I don't think you should have it as part of your collection.
Okay, and again, complaining about books is almost as much fun as reading about them, so that part's okay. So when someone comes in, they say, you know, this book should be restricted or removed, and we say, okay, we have a process that we follow that librarians call request for reconsideration. And what that means is instead of just a knee-jerk response to say, what, you found a bad word on page 17, we sit down and look at the material selection policy that was used to govern what we bought in the first place. Then usually a committee is put together that represents various different perspectives and groups, and then they sit down and read the entirety of the book. That's very important. Consider the entire service, and then sit down and say, how does that fit with our policy, and do we believe that it should be retained, restricted, or removed? And when it follows like that, then they say, okay, we make a recommendation then to the administrator, could be a library director. And if someone disagrees with that, then there could be an appeal that goes to a governing body, so a school board or a library board. And after that, it's final.
Let's talk about that middle option you mentioned, restricted. It's not an either or, but how would that work if somebody says, okay, we're fine with having this in the library. We don't want it as accessible to kids under age, I don't know, 12.
Well, my story about that one goes back to when I was a kid, and I was 14 years old, and I had just kissed for the first time, and I went to look up some of the stuff, and so I, being a good library user, I went to the card catalog and looked up the word sex, and there really was a heading in my public library that said, for sex, see librarian. And what I loved about that, you know, that could have been a potentially very popular service, but in fact what it meant was you go to the library and say, I'm looking for this book, but of course you're very nervous when you do something like that. And then there was a special location somewhere in the back room or under the desk or somewhere hidden. Well, what we've learned as librarians is that special collections are basically hidden collections. Nobody asks for them. Nobody uses them. It's like buying a book and putting it in a box. It doesn't serve any purpose.
But a parent might say, okay, I don't want my 14-year-old, great. My 5-year-old, they're maybe not ready, I think, as a parent for some of this material. How do you display it so that maybe that 14-year-old can get to it, the 5-year-old doesn't stumble onto it?
Well, libraries have always had sections within the building that kind of are targeted to specific ages. So if you're a preschooler or somewhere between the ages of 3 and 7 or 8, you're hanging out in the juvenile picture book area and the easy readers. It's not in the same location within the library. And I think that the other thing that we should remember is that, first, I don't think that children can read too much. I really don't. And I also think that if you're 5 years old, you're not interested in the things that a 14-year-old is interested in. You're not going to pick up the book and read it.
Talking to Jamie LaRue, director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. It's Banned Book Week. And, Jamie, let's get into some of the most commonly challenged books of last year, the most recent year, 2017. One that's come up, I assume, because of a Netflix series, 13 Reasons Why by Jay Asher. Can you talk about that book?
Yeah, I sure can. When it first came out in 2007, and I should say the topic of the book is suicide in high school. So a main character commits suicide, and the rest of the book kind of goes through is that why did she do that, and all the people who were involved in that decision. So when it came out in 2017, a lot of school administrators and superintendents and principals pulled the book before anybody even asked for it, and that's because there is a justifiable concern. Sometimes we have suicides in schools and they become almost contagious. And so administrators are very worried about that. But then librarians stand up and they say, well, the reason we bought this is because there are children who are dealing with this. We have people in our high school. And at least this gives us a way to say that you're not alone and we can talk about it and there are resources that we can make available to you. Well, when the Netflix series came out, the book, again, was challenged. We saw a big surge in the challenges to it. Even though the book and the Netflix series are very different, in the book, the girl who kills herself does it by taking sleeping pills, and in the series, it's more graphic. There's a razor blade involved. And so, once again, we find that in those places where there was no librarian, the worried superintendent or principal came in and removed the book and didn't say, and no one said anything. It just disappeared. But where there were school librarians, they said, we bought this for a reason. There is a process that we have to follow before it's removed. And in many cases, what they then do is invest in things like websites on a school catalog to say, if you are thinking about this, these are resources. And so, of course, librarians feel that, A, we are defenders of the right to inquire, and B, rather than just silence people who are saying things we don't want to hear, we think that more speech is better than less speech. Silence serves nobody, and sometimes speaking can save a life.
A couple other books on the challenge list, I Am Jazz by Jessica Herthel and Jazz Jennings, I'm sorry, and George by Alex Gino, both deal with gender identity. Can you talk about why these are commonly challenged?
Yeah, in fact, 50% of the books that were challenged in 2017 fall into LGBTQ. And one of the things I often believe is that when we roll out this list every year and go back and tally all of the challenges that have been reported to us, it's kind of a snapshot of what mainstream America is worried about this year. And so LGBT has been in the news quite a lot. And so the fairly small smattering of books that have begun to be published and show up in libraries are getting some significant pushback.
And then another one, Angie Thomas. This has gotten a lot of attention lately, The Hate U Give. This is a different category. I think it deals with racial issues.
Yeah, this is one. In fact, I believe the movie is just coming out about it. And it's about a young black girl who sees a friend of hers get shot by the police. And so she works through, and I think a very interesting way to say, you know, this is the experience from the police side of it, from the high school side of it, from the white side of it, from the black side of it, and it's a powerful and moving story.
And a couple of recurring titles that seem to come up year after year, I'll throw out a few of them, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Kite Runner, and The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Why do some books like that come up again and again with challenges over the years?
You know, sometimes I believe that the best definition we have of a classic is something that irritates one generation after another. And by that I mean it says something powerful and significant and it makes us uncomfortable. And so, like, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian talks about the real difficulties faced by Native Americans growing up in a culture that has almost destroyed theirs. The Kite Runner talks about the very difficult issue of you know, conflict between cultures and sexual violence and its effect on young people. So it's and The Killer of a Mockingbird deals with race, which is something that America continues to grapple with. So I think that it's not surprising that the books that wind up being banned are also on classic lists.
Are library programs sometimes challenged, apart from the materials themselves?
Yeah, we're actually starting to see quite a shift in the landscape of libraries. It used to be it was just books. And now it's displays, and ironically, often the displays that are challenged are banned books week displays, where someone will come in and say, you know, that book there, that's really offensive. I understand that you have to have it, but just don't show it to anybody. Or we have challenges that are done to speakers, not even necessarily library programs, but someone in the community might say, I want to do a program that has to do with, the connection between autism and vaccinations. And so someone will push back and say, well, the library shouldn't permit that to happen. So we live in increasingly censorious times, I believe.
Leave us with a message to people who use their libraries around the country. Why Banned Book Week is important.
Let's remember that the First Amendment is all about our individual right to inquire. It's our right to learn. As we look around the world and say, what are all the problems that we face? Reading too much isn't one of them. The more kids read, the more prepared they're going to be for life, and the more that kids and adults talk about those books together, the better we'll understand each other.
Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jamie LaRue is the director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. He joined us last week to talk about Banned Book Week. Now, in a 500-page report released in July by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Trump officials acknowledged rising global temperatures, and more specifically that temperatures would rise by 7 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. The report was meant to bolster President Trump's decision to freeze fuel economy standards for cars and trucks built after 2020, the justification apparently being that these rising temperatures were already inevitable and tougher emission standards wouldn't make a difference. Our next guest is here to talk about the report, the Trump administration's relationship to climate change, and what policies could be put into place to address these rising temperatures. Rachel Cletus is the policy director for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, how do you read this report saying, yeah, temperatures are going up by 7 degrees by the end of the century, but this particular action would be too small of a difference maker to bother implementing?
Wow, it's such a stunning, cynical statement from this administration. To talk about 4 degrees C, 7 Fahrenheit increase in temperature so blithely as if this wouldn't cause such significant climate impacts and such significant economic harms, it's just stunning to see this. So let me get one thing clear. We are not locked into a 7 Fahrenheit 4 degrees C increase. Our choices today still matter. And the choices we make today, in particular about the way we use energy and how we cut our emissions, will make all the difference in terms of the temperature increases we'll see. We've got to keep temperature increase far below this.
Now, talk about the impact of this kind of change in average global temperature, because on a day-to-day basis, a 7-degree difference doesn't sound like much. But what does that mean in a global perspective?
Well, to give us a sense of what the science is showing us, just last year at the end of November, the Climate Science Special Report was released. This is done by the U.S. Global Change Research Program. It's a consortium of 13 different federal government agencies. And this report essentially is the best available science captured about the impacts we're already seeing in the United States, as well as projections of what might happen as emissions rise. And what's stunning in the report is it captures how much of these impacts we're already seeing at temperatures that are just at about a degree increase above pre-industrial levels. We're already seeing global average sea levels that have risen by 7 to 8 inches. Along the east and Gulf Coast of the U.S., we've seen much higher rates of sea level rise increase. We're seeing coastal flooding go up. We're seeing wildfire seasons worsen, get longer and more intense. We've seen worsening drought, heat waves, extreme precipitation events like we saw with Hurricane Florence and Hurricane Harvey, and in the Midwest earlier this spring. So we're already seeing climate change is already here. So when we look ahead and when we see the choices we have ahead of us, it becomes crystal clear we've got to do our best to limit these kinds of impacts from worsening.
And I want to touch on something you said up front there. Some people might look at this and say, oh, we're already feeling climate change. We missed our window. There's not much we can do. And you say, no, that is not the case. Why not?
Every fraction of a degree we can avoid makes a difference. And that's the crucial thing that we have to understand. We're already, unfortunately, locked into a lot of very serious climate impacts because of our past and current emissions. But we do still have choices. And those choices can make all the difference between parts of the world that will become uninhabitable, including along our coastline here in the U.S., or places in the Southwest that will see worsening heat waves, and places that might be saved if we are to limit temperature increases. These harms will grow exponentially as temperatures rise. There are also some dangerous feedback loops that start to kick in at higher temperatures. We'll see runaway ice sheet loss, which will contribute to really catastrophic sea level rise. We could see changes in permafrost melting, ocean acidification, which can really affect our fish and ecosystems in the ocean. So these are the kinds of impacts that we want to do our best to avoid, and we still have a chance of limiting some of these worst impacts.
Talking to Rachel Cletus from the Union of Concerned Scientists, talking about climate change. A report out from the Trump administration predicts a 7-degree increase, that's Fahrenheit, by the end of the century, but says a particular policy change, fuel economy standard increases, more strict standards, wouldn't make a big enough difference. And Rachel, as we turn to policies, let's start with this one. What kind of impact can fuel economy standards have on greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, fuel economy standards are critical to lowering the emissions from what is now the largest source of heat-trapping emissions in the U.S. So it's a really important sector of the economy that we have to try to limit emissions from. And these were very sensible standards that had been agreed to. These were standards that both the industry and environmental groups supported. They were standards that were not just going to help limit emissions from the sector, but were also going to create a generation of cars that would be safer, more fuel efficient, that would pay consumers back in their pocketbooks in terms of saving fuel costs. So there are lots of good reasons to implement these standards. And this reversal should be seen for what it is. It is a cynical ploy to prop up fossil fuel interests. This is not serving the interests of the American public. These vehicle efficiency standards were widely accepted, appreciated. They were going into effect. And now, just like across the board, across climate policy, this administration is turning back the clock. Whether it's a power plant carbon standards, vehicle efficiency standards, or standards to limit methane emissions, which are also a highly potent heat-trapping gas from the oil and gas industry.
You had mentioned power plant emissions, and that's been another big change from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. Can you talk about what's changed in the last couple of years?
Well, what has changed, unfortunately, is that fossil fuel interests have given marching orders to the administration. The administration has appointed at the very highest levels of agencies like the EPA folks who really are doing the bidding of these fossil fuel interests. They are not looking out for the mission of the agency, which is to protect public health and well-being. That is what the EPA's mission is. And climate change is posing such significant problems to our economy, not just in dollar terms, but harm to people, that it's really an abdication of the agency's duty to the American public to see it roll back standard after standard. These protective standards deliver not just cuts in heat-trapping emissions, they also deliver a lot of public health benefits from reducing co-pollutants like mercury, nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, particulate matter, all of which cause a huge public health burden to Americans. So we're seeing them roll back every national climate and clean energy policy we have, and it is really a very sad, very dangerous set of actions.
A big argument from the Trump administration and others is that some of these climate change-related regulations were hurting the economy or would hurt the economy, whether it's in terms of more expensive cars, more expensive energy. What do you say to those concerns?
These are completely spurious arguments. They're such, you know, they're the opposite of what is actually happening. So if you look at the power sector, for example, what we're seeing in the marketplace is that cleaner forms of energy like solar, wind, even natural gas are winning out against coal. They're winning out in the marketplace because they're cheaper. They're cleaner, they're more desirable. People are really embracing, utilities and consumers are embracing these new forms of energy. So in a desperate attempt to prop up coal, they're now trying to float these ideas of bailouts for old coal plants. This is just, you know, it's so blatantly against what would help us in terms of moving towards a clean energy economy. So it's really important to recognize that the totality of the actions they're taking across the board and the rationale for them is so flimsy. This is not about the economy because the economy is thriving even as we're moving to these cleaner forms of energy.
We're talking to Rachel Cletus right now, Policy Director for the Climate and Energy Program for the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's with us to talk about a recent report from the Trump administration that acknowledges that temperatures are rising globally, will rise probably over the next 80 years, but argues against particular forms of action to stop that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this news? What actions, what policy changes do you think should be taken to address climate change? Or are you worried that we're too far gone? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about climate change and the Trump administration's call to lift emissions regulations because it sees rising global temperatures as inevitable. Our guest is Rachel Cletus, Policy Director for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about climate change, science, and policy? Do you think the Trump administration is correct when it says, in this one report anyway, that rising global temperatures are inevitable? What steps, what policy changes would you like to see when it comes to tackling climate change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Jonathan is with us in Madison. Jonathan, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I guess what I wanted to bring up is that I think that our simplest approach to climate change and also actually improving the the economy would actually be to incentivize farmers to take on regenerative practices and then also educate them on how to do so, because our most affordable and most powerful way to sequester carbon is actually through photosynthesis. And we can do this through grazing animals. We can do this through growing crops as well, as long as we're not relying on these inputs to produce our food. And then also the impact of animals, we can also reduce that impact by raising them in a more natural way.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. Rachel, do you see agriculture and different agricultural practices as part of the solution?
Absolutely. We do have to manage our lands, our agricultural lands, our forests, and our farming practices in a manner that will help us store more carbon in soils, release less methane and other heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere. So folks might know that already right now our lands in the U.S. are what they call a net carbon sink. They help sequester carbon. That means they're storing carbon and helping us reduce the amount that's released into the atmosphere and contributing to climate change. What's worrisome, though, is as temperatures rise, we will start to see some of this land sink start to dissipate. our forests might start to die out. We're already seeing this in some of our western landscapes. As we have wildfires, we might start to see that stored carbon being released into the atmosphere. So we really do have to safeguard this sink and, in fact, enhance it. Your caller is absolutely right. There are practices that we can undertake on our farmlands, in our animal rearing practices, that can help limit the amount of emissions and even serve as a way to store emissions in our soils.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. Going out to Tony, calling from Madison. Tony, hello.
Hello. I guess I was just thinking of something that Gaylord Nelson, the senator who gave us Earth Day, once said when he was confronted with economic challenges to environmental regulation. He said, you got to remember that the economy is a fully owned subsidiary of the environment. No environment, no economy.
Tony, thanks a lot for the call. Rachel, what do you think of the Gaylord Nelson quote?
Wow, that really, you know, I couldn't agree more. People tend to think of these things as, well, we have to make a choice. But in fact, history tells us, experience tells us, that it's when we do, when we invest in our economy and our environment side by side, that's when we get the best outcomes in terms of our prosperity and our growth. So, you know, just last year, for example, we had such a number of terrible extreme weather and climate-related events, a terrible hurricane season, flooding, etc. We had over $306 billion worth of damage, according to NOAA, from these events just last year. So let's not kid ourselves. This is not about, quote-unquote, just an environmental problem. Climate change is going to touch every aspect of our life, and it will and is already is affecting our economy. So we have to take this seriously.
Tony, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Rachel Cletus from the Union of Concerned Scientists about climate change. Before we go back to our callers, Rachel, I've seen some arguments that absent action at the federal level, there's an opportunity for city and state governments to step up on climate change issues. Is that something you're seeing happening?
Absolutely. I think what's been crystal clear is even though we have no leadership from the Trump administration, around the country there is a very different sentiment. We've seen states, cities, universities, tribal nations, we've seen absolute outpouring of support, for example, for sticking to the goals of the Paris Agreement. Everyone understands that we're doing this not because of some faraway distant future or an agreement that was forged somewhere else. We're doing this because it matters for our lives, for our children's lives, for our grandchildren's lives. This is about the kind of world and the economy we want to leave them. So, yes, in the absence of leadership from the administration, there are many, many entities around the country, businesses, religious leaders, labor leaders, etc., stepping up to say, well, we're going to do it anyway. And they're showing that it can be done. That said, we absolutely do still need national action. We need an administration that takes the science seriously, that understands the implications of the science, and enacts policies in line with it.
Let's go back to your calls now. Connie is with us in New Lisbon. Connie, hello.
Hello. My comment is, it seems like a lot of the ways we try to save energy and preserve the environment aren't so healthy for us in the long run. And I'm thinking specifically of two things, compact fluorescent bulbs, which I have to put in the hazardous waste at the recycling center, and then also the batteries and the hybrids, which we still don't have a good solution for how to manage them long term. What do we do with them? How do we recycle them if we even are able? And I don't like the idea of those things being around for my daughter and any, you know, grandchildren they may have in the future.
Thanks for the call, Connie. Rachel, do you see these worries about environmental trade-offs, more energy efficient, but downsides?
There's no question that in some sense we are in a world of trade-offs. We have unfortunately delayed so long to take action on cutting our emissions that some of the choices we faced are daunting. I think, though, that we as a global community, we as a nation, need to step up to this challenge. These are not reasons to shy away from the essential imperative to lower emissions. Yes, there will be technologies that won't pan out or that will have unintended side effects that we would then need to choose other technologies and move on, innovate. But this doesn't take away from the clear underlying imperative to cut emissions. And that's where what's coming from the Trump administration is so deeply disingenuous. You know, for example, in the document that you mentioned at the top of the segment, what they say is that, we're going to need to invest in such substantial increases in technology innovation and adoption compared to today's levels. Yes, actually we do. We do need to make these investments. So, yes, it's a daunting challenge, but we can do it. We've always been a can-do nation. We've been a nation that thrives on innovation. So just because the challenge seems daunting now doesn't mean we should shy away from it. I take your caller's concerns very seriously. There are unintended side effects from some of the technologies that we are trying to employ today, but we need to work through finding solutions to those.
Thanks for that call, Connie. In our last minute or so, Rachel, do you see, in terms of public opinion, people coming more and more around to being worried about climate change and wanting to take action?
Absolutely. Around the nation, we've had such a stunning series of climate-related events over the last couple of years. There are very few Americans, real Americans out in the country who are experiencing these impacts who would dispute them. So what we need now from our policymakers is to actually work in the best interest of the American public and their constituents. Stop denying the science. Start acting in the interest of the American public. Stop pandering to fossil fuel interests. Yes, it's a difficult task, but we're up to it. And we do not want to shy away from it and doom our children to a world of 4 degrees Celsius or 7 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Cletus is the Policy Director for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She joined us today to talk about the recent report released by the Trump administration, which outlined that global temperatures are likely to rise by 7 degrees Fahrenheit by the year 2100, the impact those temperatures will have on the planet, and policy changes that might work to prevent that temperature increase over the years.